I'm very happy to be here. Lita has Ali Bajiayan. My name is Andrea Bear Nicholas. I am Maliseet Negutkuk Gawin. I am from the Tobit Reserve. We call it Negutkuk. We call the St. John River the Wolastoq. We call our people Wolastoqiyik, the people of the St. John River. And literally, it means the people of the beautiful river. Although I have to tell you, we do a lot of canoeing, and you can't even wade in this river anymore. I've had it happen now twice. My feet end up with sores when just wading in the river. So we're considering changing our name. It's no longer the beautiful river, unfortunately. It may look pretty, but unfortunately, when we say beautiful, we mean it's beautiful because it's a source of life. It's where we get our life, and therefore beautiful. I guess maybe a little bit more about myself, too. I was hired at St. Thomas University in 1992 to start work in 1993 in the Chair in Native Studies. Now, the Chair in Native Studies, everybody thinks it's the head of the department. It's not. It's a research, outreach, and part-time teaching position at the university. It's an endowed chair. In other words, a fund was placed at the university specifically to be able to hire people to focus on Native studies approximately 20 years ago. So it's been there that long. I was the first holder of the position to be required to live in Fredericton. They had one holder of the position living in Cape Breton, and she showed up twice that year. So it was part of an evaluation done just prior to my coming in to make it a much more a part of the university and much more, I guess, proactive working with the local communities as well. So one of the very first things that happened when I came to St. Thomas was that the president encouraged me to have what we called another symposium. It was a symposium on Native studies. We invited people from all of the communities in the Maritimes to come to St. Thomas to look at what UNB and St. Thomas could be doing in the area of Native studies or dealing with Aboriginal people and issues and so on. We had like five topics: economic development, education, language. I can't even remember them all, but we did have a lot of topics for a two-day symposium. We started off with language. We were still talking language into the second day. We didn't get to the other five topics except as kind of a last-minute thing on the second day. Language was very obviously the issue that provoked the most emotion, the most upset, concern around what was happening to us as a people. So I was kind of given my marching orders at that time. I was urged in very strong terms that St. Thomas should not only do something about language, but to do more than the something that universities had been doing, which up until that time included probably occasional language classes. St. Thomas had alternating Mi'kmaq, Maliseet language classes going on whenever they could find people. UNB had similar language program going on. But what the group said to me and to the universities together was that we should be really moving into the area of immersion education, of supporting it, encouraging it, helping it to happen, just working quite actively on that. And so that really became the major thrust of my, I've now been there 12 years, going on 13. But I had a couple of things I had to do first, and that was that the Native Studies program was almost non-existent at St. Thomas. It consisted of one or two courses, period, at that time. Maybe three or four. Yeah, I think about four courses, an intro to Native Studies, a couple of courses around law, because some of the previous holders of my position had been lawyers. And so there was not much in the way of courses available. So I kind of felt there's really, you know, my reason for coming to St. Thomas was because I had been working on a Maliseet history, and the university was kind of saying, well, when are you going to publish it? We're going to give you a chance to publish it. But I kind of put that also on the back burner because I felt, what's the point of sort of running with any kind of outreach or special projects unless we've really got a program to stand solidly upon? So I felt that I needed to devote, probably I did devote the first 3 years to just developing the program, getting new courses, bringing people in part-time to teach. I was still the only person there, so I was at the time the head of the program, although it wasn't supposed to be my job. So About a year after I got there, I invited a woman whom I had heard in 1989. Her name is Dorothy Lazor. She is a woman that just absolutely opened my mind. I heard her in 1989. Somebody at St. Thomas had brought her to the campus to speak about immersion education for the Mohawk people. As it happens, she had been the founder of the Mohawk Immersion Program, and almost 20 years prior to that, had started that program single-handedly. Actually, it wasn't 20 years. At that time, it was 89. It had started in 81, so it's been about 24 or 5 years since it started now. But the reason it had started at Ganawage was that Bill 101 was requiring that the Mohawk parents had to have their children educated in French to some extent, and I forget how that worked. And the parents, who were mostly English speakers, because the Mohawk people are a people that are straddled the American-Canadian border. They have had a long history of working in the States in various ways, but most notably high steel. There is a large Mohawk population in New York City, for example, working on high steel. So the Mohawk families, many of them, not all of them, started to say, why should we have to learn, have our children go to school in French when we actually have our own language and we already speak English? So there started to be a real grassroots kind of revolution there. The reality was that at that time, Ganawage had, as according to Dorothy, this many speakers in a community of 7,000 at that time. She came herself from the community of Akwesasne, which had a stronger language base in the community. So when she got to Ganawage, she was... Actually, this is another interesting twist. She was a nun in a religious order out of Montreal, teaching in the school at Ganawage, the reserve school. But she was probably the only fluent speaker of Mohawk in that whole community, in a category of being either a teacher or a young person, because all of those speakers were quite a lot older. So when the parents started to get upset, I mean, that Bill 101 was truly the catalyst, started talking to her about what can we do, they started literally an underground program in the Mohawk language for the children of the parents who wanted their children to learn in the medium of Mohawk. This isn't language classes to learn to speak Mohawk. These were children who were going to start possibly nursery or kindergarten, I just quite forget. They started with this group in someone's basement, and by the time those children got to grade one, I believe there was at least a threat that they were not going to send their children to the school unless they had a speaker who would be able to teach them in grade one in their language. And what Dorothy had been doing actually was moving up with the children anyway. That original group started maybe 4-year-olds, and then she went to 5-year-olds. They got it so that she could actually teach a whole class from grade one out of 4 grade ones. She was the 4th grade one teacher of that classroom, and they started the immersion program in the school proper. About, now she's had these children for 2.5 years, the middle of grade one. Other parents in the community started coming to the principal and other authorities in the community that these children are being hurt, that these children are having their opportunities for a real education be jeopardized, that this is not going to work, that this just simply isn't a good educational project. And some of the old fears about maybe these children are only going to know Mohawk, and maybe they're not going to be able to function in the larger society. Mind you, every one of these children came from an English-speaking home. And still, the community was starting to get very scared and starting to agitate for a test in the middle of grade one for English proficiency. All grade ones were going to take this test. Dorothy was a little worried, of course, so I think just in the lead up to the test, she started spending some time teaching them a little English. But it was, you know, there wasn't much of a window apparently there. They already knew English anyway. They were all already fully fluent in English. When the test results came back, about a month later, the principal invited her into his office and sat her down, and with a stern face, he said, "I want to know what you're doing to those kids." And then a smile broke out. He said the total score was 25. The average for all of the classrooms was 18 English proficiency, and her class had averaged 24. This is a perfect example of the research that is coming out around bilingualism, around immersion education, and so on. So when she presented to us, there was a large group of people from my community, Tobik, in this room. It was just a large classroom at St. Thomas. I had a lot of questions for her. I said, what about the fact that your community would be divided, like our community is horribly divided at this point? And she said, look, the answer to that is simply work with the parents who want it. Don't impose it on anybody, just work with the ones who want it. She said, we found that we had to start refusing people over the years when people started to see these children were coming up able to be fully fluent in their own Mohawk language when even their parents weren't. And to find out that the children in those classrooms were also doing well in school. Of course, by 1989, actually, they probably had many, I believe the school went up to grade 8 at the time, and so that they were just beginning to move them on to other kinds of high schools, which in their community would have meant many choices. They could have gone to French schools, they could have gone to the Mohawk Freedom School, they could have gone to the Mohawk Community English Language School, but the immersion didn't go beyond grade 8 at that time. Almost all of those students did extremely well in the years following, and when it came time to go to universities, universities were scrambling for them, offering scholarships to them because they were near the top of their classes. The Mohawk community has now got a very large machinery around teaching people the language. When you consider that 25 years ago there were this many people speaking the language and they were all older folks, and now they've got probably 500 over the past 25 years of relatively young adults who are able to speak their language. There has been a real revival of the language in that community as a result. One of the things that they now do is they now have major adult programs. They have the school on a solid foundation now, and now what Dorothy has been doing for the last several years, although she just moved to Akwesasne, is that they have programs for adults, and those programs are sponsored by all departments in the community. So the police pay for two or three people, and they pay a full salary to somebody to take the place and pay for this person to go into this program. To my way of thinking, that's really been a large part of our problem. In my community right now, we have people, all of our teachers in our school, almost exclusively, there might be one or two non-native teachers who weren't through the program, but primarily the teachers in the school in my community all went through that program. And none of them supported the immersion effort that we've been working on through St. Thomas University until quite recently. And the principal who actually went through the native teacher training program here at UNB has been opposed to it. And she's a fluent speaker of our language. So I have to say, and this is not a popular opinion of mine, but I believe that when you have a non-native person teaching a group of native children, a non-native speaker who doesn't teach our language, the children read into that, okay, this is the way to go, and that's enough of a unwritten, unspoken message that this person is being put before them. But when you put one of our own people who actually speaks our language in front of our children, and they don't use that language at all, they use English almost exclusively, there's another huge message the child is getting. That, okay, somebody speaks my language, they have obviously chosen not to even use it. What's going on in the child's head? It may not even be a conscious thought, but this certainly is part of the indoctrination that we talk about in the article. The indoctrination, and this is really where the word neocolonialism comes in, where our own people have been unconsciously turned into purveyors of the larger ideology out there that A, our language isn't good, and B, our culture, our way of life, form of life is not useful either. That we are here in school, we are using non-native curriculum all the way through. another problem that I see with the teacher training programs is that when you want to say to those people, you want to encourage them, and even some of them were kind of enthusiastic about our language, when you say to them, okay, maybe what we need to do is start teaching our school in our language, well, you're really saying to them that they've got to go back and get a little more education. They've really got to start rethinking everything that they've learned, and they probably need different techniques, because if you're teaching subjects through our language, our methods, our language requires different ways of approaching a child in the first place. The language is the way of life. The language is our connection to the land. As soon as that river started to be polluted and we could no longer drink it, mind you, we used to be able to drink that water, not in my lifetime, but certainly back many decades ago, we could drink that water, we could live off that river, we could be in it, swim in it, everything, use it for everything, and we did. We used it for our, it was our major communication route by canoes and so on. As soon as the environment is getting polluted, destroyed, you're cutting people off from their language. You no longer have the need for probably a good third or quarter of your language right off the bat. And vice versa. If you take a language away from a child or from a people, then you've cut off the ways of interacting with that land as well. And a very important point, we recently had a symposium on immersion education sponsored by St. Thomas University and the Assembly of First Nations. One of our speakers was Tove Skudnab Kangas, who has written this enormous book as one of hundreds of articles and books that she's written. She's spent her whole life around the very topic I'm talking about. The title of this book is Linguistic Genocide in Education. Subtitle is Or Worldwide Diversity and Human Rights. She's got a whole section in here on the relationship between indigenous languages and a linguistic diversity and biodiversity. Her position is that destruction of languages comes before destruction of biodiversity, because as colonizing powers went around the world in order to get at those environments and those resources that they were there to get and take, they needed to separate the indigenous peoples from those lands so they could get at those resources. And so therefore you have a reason for attacking a language and a culture, a reason for pulling or tearing those people away from their land. And it is very effective. It has been very effective. In Canada alone, you look at a map and you see where Indigenous people live. They're little specks on the map. They probably don't even show up as more than a dot across the country. We have 600 First Nations communities in Canada, and very few of them will show very much of a landmass. St. Mary's, for example, until about 60 years ago, was 2.25 acres. For almost 100 years, they were living on 2.25 acres. Because of the overcrowding, the government eventually relented and got them a larger landmass, but it's something like 5 miles long and 2 streets wide, if any of you have been on that in that First Nation community just across the river. And the same can be said, the Oromocto community has only, I think it's like 70 acres. It originally was double that. The base Gage town took half of their reserve away from them just after World War II. And there's another bad story. They tried to move all of them to Kingsclear, only half of them went. They were lured into going with very big promises of a house and a farm and farm equipment and all of that. They got there. The farm equipment was one tractor that they had to rent to use. The livestock was a herd of goats that they had never seen in their life, much less eaten. The houses were actually, the houses moved out of Ripples, which was the German prisoner of war camp, out of town, out of Fredericton. They were filled with lice. They were, you could see the grass growing underneath them through the floors. Those were the new houses and the farm equipment and the livestock that they got. Many of the families went back by canoe to Oromocto. When they got there, they either found their houses burning or on skids already moving, going up to Kingsclear. A tremendous story that has not been told anywhere. But all of this is all of that effort to separate us from our lands, from our kin as well, to break up our communities, really to destroy us. And this is why people like Tove use the word linguistic genocide, because part of that breakdown or that destruction of a community is to first destroy the language or to deprive the children of the opportunity to learn it. Another example is we have probably 200 terms for kinship, whereas in English we have a very limited number of terms for kinship. For us, we have a separate word for a younger cousin and an older cousin on the mother's side, and so on. All of those particular relationships that actually convey an idea of respect or responsibility. So if it's an older male cousin, for example, there's a relationship under which I am required to respect this person, and that term conveys that respect. If you destroy all of those kinship terms, you are destroying the kinship connections and the kind of glue and social conditions under which that culture has survived for eons. And that is also part of what is going on when you destroy a language and when you deprive children from learning within the language. Now, the government has said to us, well, we'll give you your language, we'll teach it to you in the public schools. Well, guess what? That's been going on for the last 30 years. If any of you are from Fredericton and would have known my husband's aunt, that would have been Mrs. Christine Solis, who taught in South Devon School. She taught for 25 years in the school. Because St. Mary's was running out of speakers who were also educated to teach, because those were the only ones the Department of Education would allow in the schools. You had to have your teaching license and your teaching degree. She was the only one who spoke the language, had the license, had the commitment to teach in the public schools. She was 75 years old when she died on the job. And since then, they haven't been able to keep or to get a very solid teachers. They've got a few that aren't anywhere near the fluency, anywhere near the teaching abilities and love of the children that Mrs. Solis had. So one of the things we're facing right now, and this is what also came out in our symposium at St. Thomas 12 years ago, is that we're running out of people young enough to teach our language. Okay, here are the stats. We no longer have child speakers in Maliseet, even though there have been 25 to 30 years of teaching our language in the public schools. Well, first of all, think about this. Christine Solis had only 15 or 20 minutes a day every other day with those children, number one. And I understood she was in a little mobile for a lot of those years, and it would be 5 minutes to get the kids undressed and dressed, coming and going. So she really only had maybe 10, 12 minutes to teach every other day. But there's an even worse problem going on in that kind of situation, and that is that the children are learning, quote unquote, the real subjects in English. There's another message that the children get, that the important stuff is being taught in English, so I really do have to learn English, and this language stuff is just a frill, it's just something a little extra the school is offering us. Well, you know what? It's a little more than that. In fact, I would dare to say it's insidious, because those language programs in the public schools are actually being used as window dressing to say to our people in our communities that, oh, we care about your language and we are going to do something for your language. We are going to pay a speaker of your language to come in and teach to your children your language. Well, not one child in all of those 25 years, and I know Christine lamented this fact, not one child came out of that program fluent in the language. And in fact, if you look back over the past 40 years, that has been the sharpest decline in language abilities in our communities, the very sharpest. The charts that we've done up, I meant to bring one, show that, you know, the elders in this 50, 60, 70 category are all pretty much 100% fluent, maybe 60, 70, 80 category. We did this study 10 years ago in 1996, and it was definitely 50, 60, 70s, and 80s were pretty much 100% fluent, and then the drop-off by successive decades of age was very sharp, to the point where most of the communities in the Fredericton area 10 years ago had no child speakers, nobody under 20. So you just add 10 years to that, nobody under 30 or 40 really now. The number of people in the 20 to 30 10 years ago was very minute to begin with. So we really don't have any people of childbearing age speaking the language either. And these are the most stark and obvious indicators of a language that is facing extinction almost immediately unless something drastic can be done. So I say that our window of opportunity is really in the next 10 years. I was saying 20 years, 10 years ago. I'd say it's now 10 years left because all of our speakers are over 50. We might have one or two under 40. They are mostly not even in the Fredericton area. They are mostly in the Tobik area up near Perth Andover, 2 hours from here. And as you recall, I had mentioned earlier that the principal in that school was not for immersion, was not for language. She had a job to do, and this is not a criticism of her personally. It's really a critique of the teacher training programs that basically gave our people, all of whom came in 25 to 30 years ago with the language, all of them were fluent speakers at the time. They were all 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on at the time, all speakers of our language. They were not given the option or the opportunity to take their teacher training in the language. They were not encouraged to consider doing their teaching in the language. In fact, I know many people who went through that program who were not even allowed to do their practice training within our community schools. They were very specifically told that they were not allowed to do that. Because the idea is to indoctrinate now the teachers to teach the way teachers do in schools off reserve and to bring that back to our communities. So if they succeeded in that situation, then that's exactly what they were going to do because that's what they were being rewarded and graded and passed for being able to do. So that part has been very effective. And I don't say necessarily that that was with ill intent to the extent that people specifically wanted to destroy the languages. It was part of a general ideology that the languages were really not going to get us anywhere. The languages were really not adequate for modern subject matter. The teachers really needed to learn the dominant society and to be part of that process and project within our communities because our children were going to be hurt if all they knew was our own language. Well, I smile because, in fact, what Dorothy Lazor did with the Gunawagi people shows the absolute opposite, that those children all did well in school. The principle is that they do as well as or better, very much across the board. So there have been a number of studies, in addition to what Tove Skudnab Kangas has been teaching, is that there are a lot of people doing this kind of research now, but it just is not getting out into the public. And so what we're dealing with within our own community is parents who have been through an educational system in which they were taught that their language was not going to get their children anywhere. So we have many, many situations where both parents speak our language, but none of the children do. Many of those situations. That's rather across the board, across the country. And that's the indoctrination that was really intended. That started off with very overt punishment. As you already have probably talked about residential schools, the punishment was very overt. Needles in children's tongues if they spoke the language. Mouths washed out with soap, very drastic punishments, very horrible stories of all kinds of sexual, physical, psychological abuse. These things were being done in the name of what was good for the child, so that people were doing this fully believing that they were doing something that was right. But we now, of course, know that it wasn't right with all of the public revelations that have come out. It really took those public revelations for people to realize that this was a horrible story. It was a crime. It was genocide. Well, I'm not going to go through the Genocide Convention. I am going to mention three parts of it, though, and there are only really five major parts of in terms of the five definitions of genocide. And one of them is actually in this paper, and it's the idea of removing, I'm paraphrasing, of removing a child from one culture to another. That is genocide. And that is exactly what the residential schools were doing up until the last one closed in 1986 in Canada. And guess what? That clause in the UN Genocide Convention did not get into the Canadian Criminal Code as genocide. It was left out, rather conveniently, because this was framed back in the late 1940s in Canada or shortly after. Residential schools were still in practice at the time. Well, I actually would like to take that a step further. Dr. Roland Christian, who is my colleague and who's coming to speak with you today, will probably use the same expression because I got it from him, but I love it. He said that when they closed the residential schools, they didn't close the project. They simply went home, changed their clothes, and continued the project in public schools, in community reserve schools. And that is really what Tove talks about in her book, is those methods used by the residential schools were primarily the overt methods of forcing children to forget or not learn or to not use their language with the intention of getting rid of the language. That was Canada's overt objective, was to get rid of these languages. And that has actually a definition that has been agreed upon by the member states of the United Nations. There actually is a definition for linguistic genocide. One of the points that I have made in this paper that the schools continue this process. Remember, they just changed their clothes and continued the project. They continued this process by carrying forward some principles from the residential school. And those are subtractive language education or submersion education. Those are in under B, any education which imposes a dominant language by ignoring, stigmatizing, and replacing or displacing the mother tongue of minority and indigenous children is subtractive language education, because it subtracts from the children's linguistic repertoire instead of adding to it. In other words, the intention is creating monolingual children in the dominant language and virtually wiping out whatever they may know of their own mother tongue at this point when the schools get them. The other word that is used, and it's Tove who has actually coined these words in relation to education, is submersion education. These are directly her points, because it is accomplished by submersing the children of indigenous and minority people in the culture and official language of the dominant society using a whole array of strategies. And I've already spoken about the blatant strategies, the sticks, in other words. But now they are more subtle strategies, praising children who do well in English and not praising them for their own language, discouraging their own language in subtle ways, and then expecting the children to sink or swim. Now, there is a whole amount of research around the fact that this kind of education not only destroys a language, but virtually destroys the child. There's a point made here that it actually stunts the cognitive development of children when this happens to them. Tove uses the other word, linguistic imperialism, when any language is imposed by a powerful state onto dominated indigenous or minority linguistic groups with the purpose of destroying minority languages and reducing the number of languages worldwide. That's what linguistic imperialism is. Another point that she has taught me that I've got in section E is that people tend to go around and say that I've lost my language, or our language is being lost. Well, that's using the passive tense in English, as if there is no agent, that it just happened, that it came to a natural death, just got lost somewhere out there. Really, there is an agent, or there are agents, and that's the point made in the next, in point F there. The extinction of most of the world's indigenous language is a direct consequence of another word that Tove has coined, linguicism, which is really the unequal division of power between linguistic groups. So you don't get away with it unless you've got a dominated group and a dominant group. And then what is practiced is linguicide, the killing or murder of languages. So we should never say language loss, we should say the killing or murder of languages, because it really is an active process by agents. And we've sort of defined them here, the powerful economic, social, educational, political, and techno-military systems of the world. And when you think back to the point I made about how colonizing powers get at the land, then you see where now powerful multinational companies are also in support of this game, in support of having one world language, for instance. English is being pushed as the inexpensive way to get everybody on the same page, so to speak, to be able to communicate, to be able to get at the resources, which is not what they'll put out as their purpose, but is ultimately what really is the purpose. And that is why you're seeing indigenous groups around the world still being physically attacked, assaulted, even though the physical aspects of genocide are usually soundly condemned internationally, but not always even condemned. But many of the companies and countries that are still in the game of exploiting the world's resources and pushing aside or destroying the indigenous peoples around the world are actually attacking, assaulting the languages in sometimes overt ways, but mostly subtle ways nowadays. So prohibiting how linguistic imperialism violates human rights, this is the other major point of her book, is that it actually violates the definition of linguistic genocide, which is there in italics under number 2, prohibiting the use of the language of the group in daily intercourse or in schools, or the printing or circulation of publications in the language of the group. And Tove has made the point that you don't have to overtly prohibit the language if you simply don't allow or provide for the opportunity or the option for people to learn in the language. You are effectively prohibiting the language. And that is what's happened in teacher training programs. That's what's happened in every school, in every First Nation in Canada and North America, and both North and South America for certain. The point made in the rest of those points under 2 are that actually this practice of linguicide fits at least 2 and most certainly 3 definitions of genocide. And one of them was the point I made earlier, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. That was what residential schools were very overtly doing. Well, if you're creating a situation where the schools within our communities are only offering English or Spanish or French as the language of instruction, then you are, in effect, forcibly transferring those children from one culture to another right within the community. And that's how insidious this whole process has become, because it almost doesn't even look like what we assumed forcibly transferring children was in such an obvious way. So that's one of the genocide conventions, Article 2E. Article 2B is causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of a group. I mentioned earlier that there is now a lot of research out there that forcing children to an education not in their mother tongue actually stunts their cognitive growth, their cognitive abilities. So even though that clause in the UN Convention E says deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, well, we've always had a problem with the deliberately in that clause, because you then need to prove intent. Well, I would argue that now that we've got research that shows that this is destructive to a child's cognitive, mental, and physical growth, that we can very easily say, there's the research, and if you still want to continue to do this and you know this research is there, then there has to be intent involved, as long as the knowledge is there. It's specific to specific UN conventions that are being violated. There is also another category I've provided here, that the linguistic human rights of children are being violated when this is being forced on them. Now, there isn't legislation internationally that really protects linguistic human rights specifically, and that's where one of the problems lies. I'll be bold to include, I heard a program on the radio the other morning, I don't know if any of you heard it on CBC, about the lynchings in Texas of black people in Texas back in the 50s, 60s, I believe, was one of the more recent incidents. And the people who were being interviewed said that until it was outlawed, people did it freely. And it had to be specifically outlawed. I have been a little bit uncertain about whether to stand up and say we do need laws around this issue, but I now believe that we do. We are facing the extinction of 95% of the world's languages within this century, unless the processes that are in place now are stopped and reversed. So it's not just a case of stopping the practices, but to reverse them and to start putting effort into reversing those. And a lot of my discussion around this issue, the rationales for immersion, did not get into the article that you read because the editors cut it, even though they assured me that they were not going to cut anything from that article. So until I got the book in hand, I didn't know that it had happened, even though I assumed it wasn't because they told me they would not be cutting anything. So I've basically given you the rest of the story, so to speak, the part that's not in that paper. I just recently got this book. It's called The Education of the Sami in the Comprehensive Schooling of Three Nordic Countries, Norway, Finland, and Sweden. The Sami people now have schools in their language all the way from preschool to the end of university. Their language was destined for extinction had this not happened. The Hawaiians, who are another model of ours, we've actually brought Hawaiians here to talk about their program. Dorothy Lazor actually helped them start their program about 20 years ago. The Hawaiians now have two schools that go all the way from preschool to grade 12 in Hawaiian. They have a university that has a whole portion of the university that's entirely in Hawaiian, so that all of those students going through those schools can now go all the way through university almost entirely in Hawaiian. They would probably choose to have some courses in English, possibly, but the availability is there. That's the point. The choice is not there for our children in the current system. And that is why it fits linguistic genocide, the violation of that, and the violation of the Genocide Convention itself. So we have 10 communities in Canada. South America has maybe one indigenous group that has education in their own language. I just recently come back from a conference in Argentina last Monday, and I was quite appalled. The Mapuche people of Argentina, they have nobody speaking their language under the age of 40. I tended to think that other parts of the world were better off than we were on this matter, but no. These people were coming to the mic and literally shedding tears and showing such great emotion and such powerful determination to get help, to find out the answers, to do something about it. For them, the difference between them and what's going on in Canada is that many of them can't even talk about it without endangering themselves physically. So at this conference, there was a tremendous need on the part of everyone from South and Central America to speak, and they did, and they spoke at length. It was very sad, but it was very encouraging to know that they were just in the same boat as we were and that we are determined now to work together. That's one thing. We recently had this conference here in Fredericton with people from across the country, and we brought the teachers or the organizers or the administrators of every immersion program in a First Nation community to this conference, and we started talking for the first time together. St. Thomas University has what is, in effect, the only native language teacher training program in all of Canada and all of North America, and probably even South America. And we are gearing up either to enlarge or to help other universities to pick up that idea, because really every university in this land. I got emails last year, believe it or not, from a department of a big university in Toronto saying, should we allow these Mi'kmaq students to write their papers in the Mi'kmaq language? And if we did, wouldn't that open the door to every language in the world? And then what will we do if that should happen? I mean, unbelievable that people would not recognize that these are the languages of this land that need to be supported unquestionably without this posturing and this resistance, really, because that's what that was. There were people there resisting this. And it's not as though there can't be found people educated enough to read these papers or to help them evaluate the work. It was going back to that indoctrination that everybody has experienced for many people in very subtle ways, but for others in rather open ways and overt ways. So there's what is called the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which has several parts of it that actually apply to this same discussion, such as encouraging regular attendance and discouraging dropout rates. Well, guess what, folks? Native people in Canada drop out at much higher than 50% rates, anywhere from 50 to 90% in Canada. And don't anybody feel that it's not happening here. In the Fredericton High School, in the year 1999 or 2000, by October, 50% of the Aboriginal students in that school had dropped out. So the dropout or pushout rates, as Tove calls them, are tremendous. The effect of that kind of education is damaging, and we now have the research to show it. Well, you know what the Fredericton High School did in conjunction with some of the Aboriginal communities? They hired some people from the criminology department at St. Thomas and UNB to do a study to determine what it is that was leading these children to lives of crime, because they were convinced that the fact that they dropped out was really the key, was really the problem. This is where the thinking is today. There must be something wrong with that community of children or that culture of those children or those children themselves. It's genetic or it's cultural. So this is what that study was focusing on. And just as a little aside, I got a call from a teacher at the Fredericton High School at the time who reported that the students who were doing the research for the faculty member who was sitting back in their offices here were actually going through the students' files right in the faculty room, laughing and joking about them, having access to all of the Native students' records. There had been no consent or permission obtained from the parents. A huge violation of a whole bunch of other principles and ethics and morals and laws. This teacher called me and told me that this was going on, and it had been going on for several weeks by the time I heard. And this teacher took a lot of flack, apparently, as a result of reporting this. So you see, we really are up against a lot of ideologies out there that are structured for very certain reasons. These don't just happen to be out there. They're part of this assimilative access grabbing. You've probably read the newspapers. Our people, Maliseet and Mi'kmaq people and Passamaquoddy people, are being arrested right and left in the woods in the province of New Brunswick. The lands that our people never surrendered, we're being arrested on. If we want to cut down a tree, I was an expert witness for a case. A man had cut down 6 sticks of wood about 8 feet long. He was arrested, big court case. It's now in the Supreme Court because we eventually won in the highest court in New Brunswick, but New Brunswick government is challenging it. We do not have a right to the land that we never surrendered according to their laws. It becomes a very obvious resource question. Keep our people out of the woods, and when I was a lot younger, our people didn't even go onto Crown land because we were being arrested right and left. And for a long time, our people didn't go onto Crown lands even to hunt or anything. My father-in-law got arrested in the week before Christmas for cutting wood on the reserve by the Indian agent. He was cutting wood because he had a family of 10 children and he wanted to buy a few Christmas presents, and he ended up spending Christmas in jail. That's the kind of oppression that most people don't hear about, and the connections between our language and the resources are never really made. So I guess if there's any message that I would leave with, it would be to understand why this is happening, not just that it is happening. And it's happening around the world, wherever colonizing has gone on. As I took a quick look at my article, I mean, I quoted from Frantz Fanon there that colonization doesn't wear just a white face. It wears a red face, a black face, a yellow face, and so on, a brown face. The trick has been to get our people to carry the project forward. And that is, in fact, what we're struggling with now, that our own people don't understand that our language might actually privilege our children to be doing better in school if they had 2 good high-level fluencies in 2 languages, that they potentially could be doing better in school. And yet we have the provincial government, the federal government, saying we've got to collaborate and find our reasons and ways to make education better for Aboriginal people. There's a big meeting going on this month between Native leaders, between provincial, it's the First Minister's Conference, right, in BC, Kelowna, BC. There is actually a lot of dissension among Aboriginal leadership right now happening precisely because some of our leadership is starting to recognize that A, it's not really, the provinces have really been violating these principles right and left. And it's not really the provinces, because we are First Nations, that we should be even negotiating with. So there is a lot of dissension. You'll probably see some of that in the paper, that the Assembly of First Nations is actually now being split over some of these issues, because people are now starting to be educated around these issues and starting to recognize that there is a systemic reason for our languages to be taken from us, to be destroyed, and a systemic reason for our education to be kept down. As long as our people can be uneducated, then we're going to be controllable. We're going to be able to be controlled and dominated forever. And this is, someone pointed out that, you know, the problem is that our students are dropping out. Yes, it is a problem, but you know what? I'm kind of glad they're dropping out, because the system is so indoctrinating them into a certain way of thinking that I really fear for our future. And I really believe that we've got to find a way to understand that and to counter it and to make sure that the education of our children, and that's why I love the idea of having our education in our own language, because there's so much more of who we are in that, so much more of human values that are there. Not that there aren't human values outside of our communities, but we all have to agree that the whole multinational capitalist way is really anti-human to begin with. It's really not thinking of human lives first. It's profit and it's exploitation and so on. And the value of human life is really quite low in that system. And that's another whole talk.